Last week, you may recollect, we saw that it's no use, no use at all, the Bodhisattva creating a pure land by his magic power, whether literally or metaphorically, and trying to hold people in it indefinitely, in a sense almost by force. It's no use, because people don't want to stay in the pure land indefinitely. It's all right for a little visit, it's all right for a weekend, but not to stay there indefinitely, not even to stay there for very long. People don't want that. Huh? They don't feel ready for the pure land, not just yet. They don't feel quite at home in it. So, as we also saw last week, the pure land has to be a joint creation. The Buddha land has to be a joint creation. It has to be built by a number of bodhisattvas working together. That is to say, by a number of people inspired by the same ideal, the ideal of supreme, perfect enlightenment for the benefit of all. In the same way, it's no use the bodhisattva, however sincere, however well-intentioned, it's no use the bodhisattva approaching everybody, every single man or woman, in the same way, the same manner. It's no use the bodhisattva trying to speak to everybody in, as it were, the same language. Least of all, we may say, speak to them all in his own special bodhisattva idiom. People are very diverse indeed. This is something which one realizes more and more, the older, the longer that one lives. People are very diverse. They have very different backgrounds. Buddha Dasa gave you some glimpse of my own particular background. I don't think it's very similar probably to the background of anybody else here this evening. So we've all got our different backgrounds, our different conditionings. We've got our different ways of looking at things, our different attitudes of various kinds. We live under different conditions, under different circumstances. We've got different occupations, different interests, different tastes, different prejudices. We've even got different virtues. So the bodhisattva, to be effective, to be a real bodhisattva, and a bodhisattva who is not effective is not a bodhisattva at all, the bodhisattva has to take all this into consideration. In order to communicate with people, he has to speak to them in their own language, literally and metaphorically. More than that, in order to be able to speak to them at all, in any way, in any sense, he has to establish contact with them. And in order to establish contact with them, he has to appear like one of themselves. He has to be all things to all men. And Vimalakirti exemplifies this, and he exemplifies it, we may say, probably more than any other figure in the whole of Mahayana Buddhist literature, with the possible exception of the Buddha himself. Vimalakirti appears among people like one of themselves. He appears among businessmen as a businessman. He appears among government officials as a government official. And above all, he appears as a layman among laymen. In reality, of course, he is quite different from other people. In reality, he's an advanced bodhisattva. But he doesn't make a point of being different. He doesn't, as it were, insist upon it. He doesn't insist upon being different. He doesn't appear, we may say, among people wearing his bodhisattva gear, so to speak. He doesn't appear among people nodding his three heads and waving his four arms, which he undoubtedly has. So this is what people expect. Very often this is the sort of thing that people expect. They think that if someone is spiritually advanced, he will appear different from others in some rather obvious, striking, peculiar, eccentric sort of way. I've got a little story that illustrates this. It's a story from my Indian experience. In fact, it's a story from my Calcutta experience. When I was in India, when I was in Calcutta, as I sometimes was, from time to time, many years ago, I happened to get to know a Bengali lady who was quite religiously minded. And one day she told me an incident from her own early life, her own early experience. She told me that when she was a very little girl, I think when she was about 7 or 8, her mother had once taken her to see the Holy Mother, that is to say, Sharada Devi, the consort of the very well-known, the very famous Bengali mystic, Sri Ramakrishna. Sharada Devi, by the way, outlived him by many years, and she was believed to be, in her own right, a very advanced person, spiritually speaking. So my friend's mother had told the little girl that they were going to see a real goddess, a Devi. Devi in Sanskrit, Devi in Indian languages generally, can mean a lady, but it can also mean a goddess. It can also mean a sort of spiritual person. So they were going to see a Devi, a real goddess. So the little girl, afterwards, she was only 7 or 8, she was very excited at the prospect of seeing a real goddess. So far she'd only seen them in the temples, only seen images of them, but here she was going to see a real goddess, and she'd heard and she'd read quite a lot about goddesses, and at last she was actually going to see one. So the visit took place, and when they got back home from the visit, her mother asked her how she had enjoyed it. So my friend said that she'd complained to her mother very bitterly. She said, "You told me that we were going to see a real goddess, but all we saw was a little old widow wearing a white sari." So she told me that she'd been so very disappointed because she'd expected to see a real goddess. She said she'd expected to see the Holy Mother much larger than life, with at least 8 arms and with fire coming out of her mouth, just like one of these Bengali goddesses that you can see in Calcutta. So we're usually unable to appreciate the fact that someone is spiritually advanced if they just look like any other person. In this case, the little girl was unable to appreciate the fact that Sharada Devi was a spiritually advanced person because she looked like just like any other old Bengali widow. So the Bodhisattva appears like other people, but at the same time he doesn't make a point of being like other people. He doesn't insist upon that either. He doesn't act ordinary in a self-conscious sort of way. It's not like, we may say, those liberal Christian clergymen who remove their dog collar, go along to the local and try to behave as though they were one of the lads. Up to a point. The Bodhisattva doesn't go around earnestly assuring people that he's just like everybody else. We could say that the Bodhisattva is simply himself. On the one hand, he doesn't behave in a special Bodhisattva-like manner. On the other, he doesn't simply pretend to be ordinary. He is ordinary. But at the same time, he is a Bodhisattva. He is himself. And because he is being himself, he's able to approach people in a natural, unself-conscious sort of way. Because he's able to approach people, he can establish contact with them. And because he can establish contact with them, he can communicate with them. There's no question of his employing a special sort of technique. Not even a liberative technique. And that's why I don't think that Thurman's translation of upaya as liberative technique is a very good one. It makes it sound as though the Bodhisattva has some sort of trick up his sleeve, or as though he tries to win friends and influence people in a smart Dale Carnegie sort of way. even the words method and means have that sort of connotation to a slight extent. But upaya, skillful means, is not really like that at all. Upaya, skillful means, is essentially a question of really being with people. It's a question of empathy. It's a question of being open to people and encouraging them to be open to you, open with you. There are several other misunderstandings about the nature of skillful means, especially as exemplified by Vimalakirti himself. In particular, there's a misunderstanding in connection with the fact that Vimalakirti lived as a layman. But we'll go into that a little later on.